to meet in the center of the picture. That's what the picture was about. Meeting. Even though you might be headed in different directions. All movement relies on that kind of tension, you know. Because of the snow, we missed most of Lucas's appointments in Kingston. My father said he didn't want a chance driving off the highway in this stuff, and he wasn't about to take a day off just for a doctor's appointment, not with Big Buck's Ballard breathing down his neck. So Lucas would have to do the best he could. My mother did the best she could by calling up the doctor's office and asking what to do, and filling the prescription for the ointment for Lucas's eyes, and checking the stumps every day to be sure there was no redness or smell of infection. You can imagine what that was like. Lucas mostly sat around the kitchen with a blanket over his lap, not because he was cold. He didn't talk hardly at all. None of us could know what it was like, he said. We weren't there. So what's the point of talking? When he did talk, he was his old jerk self again. When I told him about the moonshot and how one day there would be human footprints on the lunar surface, he said, I guess they won't be mine. And when my mother asked me to run down to Spicer's Deli for more milk, Lucas said, I'd run down for you, but... And when Christopher said he was thinking about going out for track in the spring, which is something like a miracle since Christopher has never gone out for anything in his whole life, Lucas said, I bet I could run my legs off if I tried. Oh, wait a minute. Every time he said something, that was the last thing anyone said for a long time. Which is what had probably happened the second Saturday of February, when I had been working on the gestures of the forked-tailed petrels, and I was starting to get them just right so that they looked like they were about to dance with each other. And I came back home and said to my mother and Christopher, I think I got them dancing. And Lucas said, I bet you couldn't do that for me. And the silence came down, and I thought of the yellow shank, and I said, shut up, Lucas. I'm not lying. I said, shut up, Lucas. He turned his face toward me. What did you say? Are you deaf, too? I said. He threw the blanket off his lap. He tried to raise himself up in his wheelchair. Listen, little brother. I can hear. I said. I got my legs blown off, in case you forgot. How could I forget? You tell us about it every day. I think if Lucas could have gotten out of the chair, he would have pulled my face off. My mother had her hand up to her mouth, but she didn't stop us. The thing about the forked-tailed petrels is that they only have a moment. The winds are blowing opposite ways, and each one is riding a different wind. And there's only this one moment when they can meet. It's all fired important. They can't miss it when it comes. Doug, said Lucas. He said this in a kind of snarl. You don't even try, I said. Try what? More snarling. I can't grow new legs. You have two arms, I said. They used to be strong. You used to be able to take me, Christopher said. And the doctor said that you should try leaving the bandage off your eyes, said my mother. Maybe... I'm blind. I walked over to my brother. I reached for the bandage across his eyes, and when he felt me near him, he tried to stop me, snarling. But I was a lot stronger than him now. I hadn't thought about it, but I was. So I grabbed his arms, pushed them away, and pulled the bandage off. My mother started to cry. Most of Lucas's face was still the shiny pink of half-healed skin. His eyes glistened with the ointment smeared over them. No eyebrows. No lashes. His eyes blinked and blinked and blinked. "You want to stop me?" I said. Or maybe I snarled. "Try. Hitch yourself up in that wheelchair. Try." He didn't move. He kept blinking. "Try," said Christopher. Lucas blinked again. He turned his face toward my mother. "I think I see you," he said. The next Saturday it snowed, but it didn't matter. Christopher and I carried Lucas into the pickup, and Lucas, my mother, and my father drove to Kingston early. Lucas didn't have the bandage over his eyes. He kept turning his face from side to side, blinking, trying to make things out. And he was smiling. I already told you about his smile, right? After the deliveries, I drew the forked-tailed petrels with smiles. "Birds," said Mr. Powell, "tend not to have expressions on their faces." "This is their one chance," I said. "In a second, they're going to be blown past each other, and who knows what will happen next." Mr. Powell leaned down to my drawing. "In that case, smiles are appropriate." But none of the petrel smiles could touch Lucas's smile, or my mother's smile when I got home that afternoon, or mine, probably, when I heard that the Kingston doctor thought, really thought, that Lucas's eyes might heal, and he was going to send him to a specialist down to Middletown. "He was going to send him to some guy in New York City, but I set him straight on that," said my father. And meanwhile, the doctor had some exercises he wanted Lucas to really work at for his arms and upper chest. And Lucas said, "I may need your help, little brother." And I said, "Sure." He reached out his hand, and I took it, and we shook. And his hand felt strong. "You know, I don't think the forked-tailed petrels are blowing past each other. The more I think about it, it seems to me that they're probably circling, like two wrestlers. And when the waves and the winds smack at them, they spread their wings and skitter around, and then they try to come back together again. That's what I think they're doing." On Monday, James Russell was counting my squat thrusts for the presidential physical fitness chart when he said, "I hear you've been drawing birds at the library." "Yep," I said, kind of breathless. It's hard to talk when you're doing as many squat thrusts as you can in 4 minutes. "Audubon's stuff," he said. Nodded. "You know, some of the plates are missing from that book," he said. Nodded again. I was at 63 and still had about a minute to go, which, if you ask me, isn't bad. "I know where one of them is," he said. Nodded again. "Principal Petey's office," I figured. I'd seen the brown pelican, too. "Puffins," he said. I stopped the squat thrusts. "My father bought it from the town." I'm not lying. I added another 42 squat thrusts before Coach Reed called time. If I had James Russell's father's job, I wouldn't talk about it. Probably James felt the same way, because he never talked about it. And when he told me what it was, he said that he was only telling me because I'd probably figure it out the minute I walked into his house. But I couldn't talk about it to anyone, he said. Promise? I said I'd keep a secret, and probably you shouldn't tell anyone either. James Russell's father is the first flutist of the New York Philharmonic. Do you know what my father would say if he knew that? And James was right. You could tell as soon as you walked into the house. I mean, how many houses have flute music playing on the stereo in the middle of the afternoon and loud? And how many houses have books about flutes right out on the coffee table that anyone could see right off, and sheet music everywhere, and this huge piano, and next to it a music stand with a silver flute across it? I'm not lying. You could tell pretty quick. What you might not be able to tell pretty quick when you meet Mr. Russell is that he is the first flutist of the New York Philharmonic, because Mr. Russell is bigger than Joe Pepitone and Mickey Mantle put together. And I don't mean he's fat, because he isn't. He's just huge. He stands over you like this little mountain, and he's got this dark, beardy shrubbery all around the peak, and arms like pines, and legs like oaks, and feet the size of small lakes. His hands look too big to hold anything but a boulder, one in each. And I said, "You play the flute?" And he said, "Sweetly and beautifully." Then he showed me. He was right. Sweetly and beautifully. He started with Mozart, who isn't as bad as you might think. Then some Brahms, who is as bad as you might think. Then some Joplin, who's good. And then some Aaron Copland, who Mr. Russell said was his favorite composer even though he didn't write anything for a flutist. And then he did some Beatles stuff. It didn't sound exactly like the Beatles, but it wasn't bad. And when he finished, I asked him to play the Copland again, and he smiled and did. Copland knew how to say what he wanted to say, unlike certain poets I could mention. Then James took me upstairs. He had a house big enough to fit 14 of the dumps into, maybe more. His own room was the size of our downstairs, and he had his own bathroom and tile with the grout still around it. And on the third floor, they had this room that ran the whole length of the house, about as big as left field in Yankee Stadium, which I have walked on, by the way. And right where the stairs came up to this room, the large-billed puffins were hanging. Okay, this is going to sound dumb. You know how sometimes when you haven't seen someone in a long time, and suddenly there he is, and you look at him, and for a second it's almost like he's a stranger, and then that second is gone and it's all the same? Sort of like when Holling Hood came by and dropped Joe Pepitone's jacket off last summer. That's what happened. Except that at the same moment, Mr. Russell was downstairs playing that Copland piece again. And there were those fat puffins, looking like chumps, bumbling around like they had no idea how to get on in the world, looking dumb and stupid, and so beautiful that I wanted to... Nothing. "They're kind of dumb-looking," said James Russell. "Yeah," I said. I couldn't take my eyes off them. And still, the music played sweetly. "They don't even look like they can swim," he said. The music played beautifully. Tuesday after school, I went home to do all the homework that I wouldn't be able to do that night because Mrs. Daugherty had called and wondered if I could come over on such short notice. And so now I had the Daugherty kids to read to, and we were up to this place where this spider is going to die, and a pig has to get her egg sac. I know, it sounds dumb, but it wasn't bad. So I had to get all my homework done before I went, especially for Mrs. Vern, who had already dropped two people from advanced algebra because they didn't get all their assignments in on time, and I wasn't going to be number three. But on Wednesday, I went home again with James Russell. It was raining, and we got pretty wet, walking home with Otis Bottom, too, since his house is only a couple of blocks away from James Russell's. And for the record, Otis Bottom's father has a job you could talk about. He's a doctor, which explains why his house is not on the same side of town as the dump. I guess that being a doctor and being a flutist with the New York Philharmonic pay pretty good. At James Russell's house, we visited the large-billed puffins like they were old friends. Then we played speed chess up on the third floor, which I was no good at, but he didn't wipe me out too fast. And he had a great dartboard up there, and I only threw a few into the wall instead of into the target. And then we played regular chess, and I was better at that, but he still won. And all the while, Mr. Russell was playing Copeland downstairs, and the stupid puffins were bobbling about in the water, sweetly and beautifully. On Thursday, I stayed late with Coach Reed to finish the presidential physical fitness charts. "Thanks," he said when he signed his name on the last one. "Sure," I said. I stood up to go. "Swiatek," he said. "Yeah? How's your brother?" "Surprised?" "His eyes are getting better," I said.
"That's not what I mean."
"I know. He still dreams." Coach Reed looked at me a little while, his mouth working.
"Go on home," he said, "and thanks for writing up the charts."
Then the forked-tailed petrels flew a little closer. "Do you dream too?" I said. Coach Reed looked down. He started to fuss with a bag of softballs. A long time with the fussing. Then,
"There was a kid. Younger than you."
More fussing with softballs.
"And an old man and a young girl. Probably the kid's sister. I don't know."
Fussing with softballs.
"They come every night."
"That's what it's like for Lucas," I said. He shook his head.
"I don't think so. Not like these three."
"Maybe they want you to do something," I said. He stopped fussing with softballs. "Maybe they want you to help someone." He looked at me.
"Maybe they do," he said.
That's what I mean about the forked-tailed petrels circling around and around each other until they finally meet. On Saturday, we had another snowstorm. Terrific. Before I even left the house, there was 8 inches on the ground, and I'm not talking light and fluffy here. I looked out the bedroom window and I said to Lucas, who was already doing his exercises at the side of his bed, "I'm going to be soaked up to my knees in 3 steps. And he said, "Wouldn't happen to me." I know, sounds like the same old Lucas. But if you had been there, you would have seen that he said it smiling. I was, by the way, soaked up to my knees in 2 steps. And if it hadn't stopped snowing, and the sun hadn't come out, and the sky hadn't started to blue over the tops of the mountains, I might have said, "Forget it," and headed back home. But I didn't. I drank my hot chocolate at Spicer's Deli and then set out. And Mrs. Mason was waiting with her hot milk, and I got through it. Mr. Leffler had a cupboard door that was loose, a light bulb that needed changing over the basement stairs, and a cracked window pane in the bookcase that he needed me to take the glass out of very, very, very carefully, and which he couldn't do because of his shaky hands. Mrs. Daugherty was keeping my bowl of cream of wheat hot, and she had a special treat with it, she said. It was bananas. In the whole story of the world, bananas have never once been a special treat. Then I headed off to Mrs. Windermere's, where I knew the coffee was percolating. No matter how wet and cold you are, black coffee percolating will get you through it. But I was pretty wet and cold by the time I got there. Wet and cold all the way through. And even with Mr. Leffler's gray wool cap, which I only wore because Lil Spicer said I looked good in it, which you might remember, my ears were still about to fall off. I guess you can imagine what Lucas would have said if he heard that. but now he would have said it while he was smiling. The coffee really was percolating at Mrs. Windermere's, and the kitchen was that kind of warm that goes right into you, like a blanket. I could hear Mrs. Windermere typing. Probably Jane Eyre was falling in love with Mr. Rochester right there in her typewriter. And so I put away the groceries and took two cups down from the cupboard and poured the coffee and brought the cups into her study. I opened the door and set one down next to her. You could see the vibrations of her typewriter in her coffee. And I sat down and sipped at mine and was almost half done before she looked up at me. "Jane Eyre is falling in love with Mr. Rochester," she said. "See?" "But I'm not quite sure how to show it on stage." "Maybe," I said, "he should be over at a desk, drawing something."
"Drawing something?"
And she comes up behind him and sees what he's drawing, and she thinks he's pretty cool. What happens next?
"I don't know," I shrugged. "He doesn't have any idea what to say to her."
"Maybe he should let her draw something with him," Mrs. Windermere said.
"Maybe," I said.
Mrs. Windermere nodded, then turned quickly to her typewriter and began smacking at the keys. Her hands flew high, petrels in the winds. I sipped at my coffee until I was finished with it. I got up and walked around the table in her study. It was still piled high with books. It will probably always be piled high with books. But the difference was, I could read them now. Not that I'd want to read these particular books, but I could have if I wanted to. And that makes all the difference. I'm not lying. But I don't know who would want to read these. Librettos of the great operas, snore. Life of Verdi, snore, snore. Aku Aku, which sounds like someone sneezing. History of the Old South Church, Boston. Snore, snore, snore. Even percolated black coffee wouldn't keep you awake if you were reading these. I picked up Aku Aku and looked at the book beneath it. Aaron Copland's autobiography, manuscript edition. I read it again. Aaron Copland's autobiography, manuscript edition. I picked it up. Mrs. Windermere was still typing. I opened the book. Inside the front cover, a sheet of music was pasted, handwritten. I couldn't read any of it. Maybe I should try that next. Mrs. Windermere stopped typing. "What book is that?" she said. "Aaron Copland's," I said. "The guy who writes music." "You mean the guy who tries to write music," she said. I looked at her. "Skinny delivery boy, you are talking to a very old woman who doesn't think much good music has been written since Ludwig van Beethoven finished his 9th symphony." She turned back to her typing. Her hands rose high. "So why have the book?" I said. Mrs. Windermere's hands were still high. "My husband liked to collect quirky books. That one has a page of Copland's music written in his own hand. But neither he nor I ever read the thing. Me, because I never wanted to. Him, because he didn't have enough time." Her hands came down. "Mrs. Windermere," I said, "don't make an old lady cry." "What kind of ice cream did I order?"
"Cherry vanilla," I said.
She stood up. "Let's go try some." "Mrs. Windermere," I said, "if you don't want the book much, I think I could use it." She looked at me. "Do you like Copland?"
"I do, but it's not for me."
She peered sort of slanted at me. "You have something up your sleeve," she said. I told her. Mrs. Windermere smiled, almost like my mother, which kind of surprised me. The god of creativity has folded his wings by your desk, too, she said. She took the book, held it lightly to her lips, and kissed it. It wasn't weird. It was beautiful. Then she handed it back to me. Nothing should ever sit and gather dust, she said, and we went into the kitchen and tried the cherry vanilla ice cream. On the way home, I carried Aaron Copland's autobiography, manuscript edition, underneath Joe Pepitone's jacket so that nothing would happen to it. When I got to the library, I showed it to Lil and told her, but I didn't show it to Mr. Powell.
Mr. Swiatek, said Mr. Powell, I think I can accept having the petrels smile a little bit, but that is an out-and-out grin.
I suppose so, I said. He looked at me. Rather like what you are doing right now, he said.
I guess, I said.
Mr. Powell looked at Lil.
And you too, young lady, he said.
Lil started to laugh. She looked over at me and laughed harder.
Me too.
Then Lil came up behind me to see what I was drawing. She put her hand on my arm and squeezed.
You know what that feels like?
I think you two know something I don't know, said Mr. Powell. Lil squeezed again. On Monday, I went with James Russell to his house. Mr. Russell was playing Aaron Copland's music on his stereo. I call that fabulous. Mrs. Russell made us both sit down with a glass of milk. And I have a special treat for you, she said. I'm not lying. She really said that. I held my breath because of the last special treat at the Dohertys, but it didn't help, because when Mrs. Russell came back, she came back with a loaf of banana bread. Banana bread. And James said, how about we have some jam with that? And Mrs. Russell said, jam? Then you wouldn't be able to taste the bananas. And James said, Ma, I hate bananas. And she said, but I'm sure that Doug enjoys them. And I said, I think I'm still full from lunch, so the milk's fine. And then Mrs. Russell picked up the plate with the banana bread on it, and you might not believe this, but she started to laugh and laugh and laugh until Mr. Russell came out to the kitchen to see what was so funny, and she showed him the banana bread, and he said, I hate bananas. And we all started to laugh until Mrs. Russell said, I hate bananas too. And you can imagine us all laughing until we were crying. And finally, Mrs. Russell took the banana bread outside to break it up for the birds. Let's hope they like bananas. And then I showed Mr. Russell Aaron Copland's autobiography, manuscript edition, and he stopped laughing. Remember how I told you how big his hands are? How they could carry boulders? He held Aaron Copland's autobiography, manuscript edition, like it was a half-cracked egg. I've heard of this book, he whispered, but I never thought. He was talking like you would talk just before Mass. He opened the front page, looked at the sheet of music pasted in. It's in Aaron Copland's own handwriting, I said. Mr. Russell stared at it. Then he looked at me, smiling. And we went into the front room, and he put the book on his music stand, and he played the music from the page with his silver flute, sweetly and beautifully. Fabulous. When he finished, he looked at me and said, "Where did you find this?" I told him. He shook his head. I can hardly believe it, he said. Mr. Russell, I said, I have an idea. Here are the stats for the rest of that week. Number of times I wanted to tell someone. 150,000. Number of people I told? 4. Lil Spicer, my mother, my brothers. Number of times I walked by the library, hoping that Mr. Powell might be in? 12. Number of minutes off the record for finishing the Saturday deliveries for Spicer's Deli? 17. Mr. Leffler didn't have any chores to do, so that helped. Number of minutes it took me to get to the dump from Spicer's Deli and then back to the library? 12. Probably a record. Number of seconds it took between coming to the library and Mrs. Merriam telling me not to run up the stairs? Less than 1. Amount of time it took Mr. Powell to understand what I had? I think he's still working on it. We laid the large-billed puffins back in their place in Audubon's Birds of America. It became a little more whole than it had been before. Do you know how that feels? Do you think the forked-tailed petrels were dancing now? Not much more than Mr. Powell, who first danced around the room with me and then with Lil, and then we all went downstairs to tell Mrs. Merriam. And he took her hands and tried to dance with her, but she wouldn't have any of it, even though I think she was smiling just a little the whole time she was shushing him away. That night at supper, Lucas said he wanted to go to the library before it closed to see the puffins.
"Don't expect me to carry you up those stairs," said Ernie Echo, who was eating with us. Again.
"We don't," said Christopher. Ernie Echo looked up at him from his plate. Christopher stared back. Ernie Echo looked down. "Once we get inside, there's an elevator," I said. Ernie Echo worked on his string beans. After supper, Christopher and I went with Lucas to the library. The days were finally starting to get longer, but it was still dark, and the first stars had been out for a while. Lucas looked up toward them as we went, squinting, blinking, trying to see. We carried the wheelchair up the 6 steps between the two of us, and it wasn't light. Then we lifted it over the door frame and onto the marble floor of the library, where the wheels ran quiet and smooth. Mrs. Merriam looked up to see who had come in so late, and when she saw Lucas, she walked out from behind the desk and took off her looped glasses. This didn't happen very often, and she said to Lucas, "Welcome home." I'm not lying. She said, "Welcome home," like she was bringing him into her own kitchen or something. Lucas turned his face toward her and blinked. "Thanks," he said. "When did you get back?" she said. He told her. "Where were you stationed?" Told her. "Were you near Saigon at all?" Nodded. "When?" Lucas tried to remember. Then she asked him. "While you were there, did you ever hear of a Lieutenant Merriam? Lieutenant Leonard Merriam?" Lucas thought, then shook his head. "I never did." She leaned down toward him and put her hand on his chair. "He was stationed near Saigon. You might have heard of him." Lucas shook his head again. "I'm sorry." Mrs. Merriam stood up again. She twisted her hands together. "I didn't think you would have," she said. "I never really did."
"There's thousands of guys there," Lucas said.
"I know. But your mother must be glad you're home." "Thanks," said Lucas. I told Mrs. Merriam that we were going up to see the book, and she went to the bottom of the stairs to turn the lights on, and she watched as we went to the elevator. Lucas didn't exactly like the steel gate that we had to draw across, and he really didn't like the way the elevator rattled around on its way up. And he really, really didn't like the sound of the pulleys straining themselves. And, of course, at the top, the elevator stopped a couple of inches below the floor, and we had to pull Lucas's chair over the lip. So he was sweating, and even shaky, when we got into the room with the petrels and the puffins and everyone else. But he wheeled himself over to the display case and looked in. Mr. Powell had left the book open to the large-billed puffins, and Lucas stared down at them for a long time, trying to make them out. "There's two of them," he said. "Right?" He looked down again, and after a while he said, "Lieutenant Leonard Merriam is MIA." "How do you know he's missing?" said Christopher. "I know," he said. Lucas looked at the puffins. He leaned so close that his face was almost touching the glass. "Not everyone gets to see who they want to see again. I guess I'm lucky." Mrs. Merriam was waiting for us at the bottom of the stairs. She turned the lights out when we got down. She held the door open for us. And then, I watched through the window, she went back to her desk, sat, put on her glasses, and looked at something a long way out from the library. Chapter 8. The Brown Pelican, Plate 251. You remember how I said that when things start to go pretty good, something usually happens to turn everything bad? I was starting to think maybe I was wrong. Maybe things don't always turn bad. What a chump I am. One Saturday in the middle of March, I figured out that my baseball, and you know which one I mean, my baseball that I had been keeping in the bottom drawer of the dresser underneath my socks and sweatshirt since I'd started wearing Joe Pepitone's jacket, my baseball was gone. Then, on Monday morning, I found out that Joe Pepitone's jacket was gone, too. When I asked my mother if she knew where my jacket was, she put her hands on the back of a kitchen chair and held on hard. "Could you have left it at school?" she said. "I wore it for the Saturday deliveries." "At the library?" I shook my head. "On the stairs?" "No." She held on tighter to the chair. I didn't ask any more questions. Remember how I said something usually happens to turn everything bad? Remember how I said that? My jacket from Joe Pepitone. Then, one day in late March, one of those days when the sun is sort of teasing you with the idea that maybe spring isn't so far away after all, the Tools and More hardware store was robbed again. Guess who the police came to question? Christopher said he hadn't been anywhere near the Tools and More hardware store. Lucas and I both said he hadn't been anywhere near the Tools and More hardware store. One of the policemen said, "Can we see your bike, son?" "Sure," said Christopher. We all went outside, my mother and me and Lucas and Christopher and the policeman. Christopher wheeled his Stingray up. "You're missing a pedal," said the policeman. "I lost it a few days ago," said Christopher. "Where did you lose it?" "If I knew that," said Christopher, "then it wouldn't be lost anymore."
"Chris," said Lucas, low and steady.
"You wouldn't have lost it anywhere near the hardware store?"
"No,
I wouldn't have lost it anywhere near the hardware store because I haven't been anywhere near the hardware store since I don't even know when." The policeman took a bicycle pedal out of his pocket. He slid it onto the rod on Christopher's bike. It slid on easily. I found this over at Tools and More, said the policeman, looking up at my mother. Around the back. Then he turned to Christopher. Looks like a match to me. It did. We could all see it was the right pedal. Christopher went with the policeman. I went to the Ballard paper mill to find my father. I didn't want to run into Mr. Ballard. Not right now. So I went out onto the floor looking for my father. But no one seemed to know where he was. He wasn't at his station where he was supposed to be. And he wasn't packing. And he wasn't loading trucks. Finally, one of the loaders said I should try outside past the loading dock. Maybe he was there. And he was. Taking a break, I guess. Smoking a cigarette with Ernie Echo. I told him about Christopher. And the funny thing was, my father looked straight at Ernie Echo. It was the first thing he did. Look straight at him. Ernie Echo shrugged. My father threw his cigarette away, and we went in and across the floor. Swiatek! Someone called. But my father never even let on that he heard. We went across the floor, and out the front door, and into his pickup, and on into Marysville. It took 2 hours to get Christopher out on bail, and in that time, he was fingerprinted and his picture taken for police records, and a policeman tried to get him to confess, but he kept saying he didn't have anything to confess, and he didn't know anything about the hardware store, and no, he didn't have any idea who did. And when he wouldn't confess, they put him into a cell for the rest of the 2 hours, and when he came out, he smelled like throw-up. A sergeant said there would be a hearing. They'd let us know when. And in the meantime, he looked hard at Christopher, in the meantime, if Christopher happened to remember what went on that night and where all the stuff was, maybe things would go a whole lot easier for him. Christopher didn't say anything. We went out into the pickup. My father got in the front, and I got in the front, and Christopher got in the back. Maybe because he smelled like throw-up. We drove home slowly, but word got around Marysville fast. Things at Washington Irving Junior High School did not go well the next day. Every time someone looked at me, the look said, "I know." In geography, I didn't draw the chapter review map of Northern Africa because I didn't read the chapter on Northern Africa. In world history, I told Mr. McElroy, who really cares about the creation stories of the Aboriginal tribes of Eastern Australia? In English, we were still on the introduction to poetry unit, and I'm not lying. If I ever meet Percy Bysshe Shelley walking down the streets of Maryville, I'm going to punch him right in the face. I cut advanced algebra. Coach Reed can chart his own presidential physical fitness charts. And in Mr. Ferris's class, I wasn't so all-fired excited that the command ship and the lunar module of Apollo 9 had separated and flown 100 miles apart and then come back together, just like they would for the real moonshot, which was now really going to happen, said Mr. Ferris. He put his hand on Clarence's head. It was the first time astronauts had transferred from one space vehicle to another while in space, he said. Terrific. The next morning, Principal Petey was waiting for me when I got to school. He told me to come by his office after Mr. Barber's class. Mr. McElroy already knew I'd be late for world history. And I'd better not try to get out of this, he said. Terrific. Do you know what it feels like, reviewing North Africa's geography, which you still haven't read about, while waiting to go to the principal's office, which you'd better not try getting out of? You wish there was room on the moonshot. I waited for my half hour, and when I finally got into Principal Petey's office, he looked like he wished there was room on the moonshot, too.
for me.
So, he said, you're up to your old tricks.
Lucas, the old Lucas, might have pointed out that cutting Mrs. Vern's class was a new trick, but I still get it. I didn't say anything.
First P.E., then algebra.
Advanced algebra, I said.
Not anymore, he said. Principal Petey does not give a student who lacks the discipline to go to assigned classes the privilege of attending advanced classes.
Did you know that the brown pelican's beak is about as long as its whole body? It's huge. It looks like it could open wide and fit in a whole lot. Like a principal.
Do you understand that all actions have consequences? That's what Principal Petey is trying to teach you here, said Principal Petey.
The pelican is standing mostly on one leg. The other is lying like it doesn't care on the branch. Like the pelican doesn't believe that actions have consequences, which he doesn't.
You are assigned 3 days of after-school detention, said Principal Petey, starting this afternoon. Principal Petey will be calling your home to explain why you'll be late.
The brown pelican, the way he looks out at you, that eye. He knows he's...
Are you listening to Principal Petey?
Noble. Principal Petey stood up.
Yes, I said, I'm listening. Do you want to explain to Principal Petey why you cut Mrs. Vern's class?
I didn't say anything.
Douglas, is it because of your brother?
If you wanted to draw the brown pelican, I'm not lying, it wouldn't be easy. There's something like 9 or 10 rows of feathers, maybe 11, maybe 12. And they're all shaped differently, and they all layer over each other, and the composition is fabulous. He's standing on this big old branch that's starting to decay, but it's still putting out leaves. The brown pelican is right in the middle of the picture, balancing on this one leg, and it doesn't seem like a body with so much beak in the front could be balanced, but it is. It looks like it should tip forward. All movement, you might remember, relies on that kind of tension. But he wasn't moving. He was balanced just right. It would take a while to figure out how Audubon did that.
Principal Petey sat back down. If you're not even going to look at Principal Petey, he can't help you, he said.
I looked at him. My brother... didn't do anything, I said. He sighed, like it was him that was in some sort of pain.
Principal Petey has spoken with the police about this, he said. Your brother stole merchandise from the Tools and More hardware store. He almost certainly was the one who robbed the store last fall as well. He probably is also the one who robbed Spicer's Deli last fall.
You don't know anything, I said.
The sooner you face the facts... Here's a fact, I said.
I might have been yelling, but I'm not sure.
That bird belongs back in the book it was stolen from.
Principal Petey looked sort of startled. He turned around to the brown pelican, and then he looked back at me.
That plate... was a gift from the Education Committee when Principal Petey assumed the responsibilities of being the principal of this school, he said. It was not stolen. And Douglas, it has nothing at all to do with the problem you and Principal Petey are talking about.
I have an idea, I said. Principal Petey sighed again.
When the police figure out who the thief really is, and it isn't my brother, then you have to give the bird back to the library. Principal Petey considered this for a long time. a long time. Then he nodded, like he'd decided something, and stood. "All right," he said. "All right. Principal Petey will take a chance. He will do that. Meanwhile, you, Douglas, have to promise to attend all of your classes without missing a single one. And I get to stay in advanced algebra." He considered this, then nodded again. "But you still have 3 days of after-school detention," he said. I held my hand out. He held his hand out. We shook. Over us both, the noble brown pelican watched, keeping his balance like it was no trouble at all. I served after-school detention with Miss Cowper. She gave me 3 more poems by stupid Percy Bysshe Shelley that she was sure I would enjoy. 2 vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, she said. Near them, on the sand. I really will punch him right in the face. It was late in the afternoon when I finally got out of school on the 3rd day of detention, and even though it was a pretty nice spring day still, I was a whole lot colder than I wanted to be because, if you remember, I didn't have Joe Pepitone's jacket anymore. Which is why, I think, Mr. Ballard stopped when he saw me while driving past. He leaned across the seat and rolled down his window. "Hey, my partner," he called. I waved. "Get in," he said. "I'll drive you home. Unless you have time for a few horseshoes." I got in. I looked out the window. We drove a few blocks. "Horseshoes always help me think things out," Mr. Ballard said. Another block. The dump came in sight. "I guess I have time," I said. Mr. Ballard turned toward the paper mill. Mr. Ballard was keeping the horseshoes in his office until it got warmer. So we went in together and he got them from behind the door. You should have seen the orchids blooming with all that sunlight coming in. And we went down to the horseshoe pits. The ground was still pretty soggy from the winter, and the sand around the stakes was all wet through. "It'll be a practice round," said Mr. Ballard. I threw the first shoe, way over. He threw the next one. It clanged the post and bounced off. I threw the next shoe, way over. He threw the next one, a leaner. And that's pretty much how it went, until it got too cold and we went back to the mill. Here are the stats for that practice round. Shoes way over, about 50 for me, 2 for Mr. Ballard. Shoes thrown short, none for me, 4 for Mr. Ballard. One-pointers, 3 for me, about 50 for Mr. Ballard. Leaners, none for me, 4 for Mr. Ballard, which he said was unusual. Ringers, none for me, which he said was unusual. 23 for him, which wasn't unusual. "Did you have a good game?" said Mrs. Stenson when we brought the horseshoes back up. "It was a practice round," Mr. Ballard said. He went into his office and set the horseshoes behind his door. Then he came back out. I was standing by the window. All that sunshine. Mr. Ballard stood next to me. He picked up an orchid, put it back, and chose another that was in fuller bloom. It was all purple and white and yellow, like some artist had designed an impossible bloom without worrying about composition, like he went wild and let it all go. "This is for your mother," he said, and handed it to me. And suddenly, I felt like I was going to cry.
right there in the middle of the office of the president of Ballard Paper Mill. Just start bawling like I was 4 years old or something, holding this orchid for my mother.
"It's all right," said Mr. Ballard. "Things will work out."
I looked up at him.
"Things always do."
I didn't want to tell him that he was wrong. I had seen the black-backed gull. I didn't want him to start crying, too.
"I'll drive you home," he said. "Give me a minute."
He went back into his office. Mrs. Stenson smiled at me, which was probably her trying not to laugh, me standing there about to cry, holding a flower. Then Mr. Ballard came back out of his office. He handed me a jacket.
"This doesn't fit me anymore," he said. "I'd be glad to have someone use it."
I took it. You won't believe what kind of jacket it was. And no, it wasn't a Yankee jacket, even though a Yankee jacket would have been terrific. It was a flight jacket. I'm not lying. A flight jacket. Dark leather, lined on the inside with this soft flannel stuff. Deep pockets. Turned up collar. A flight jacket. Like you'd wear if you were an astronaut on vacation walking around Marysville before you were going to blast off to the moon.
"Try it on," he said.
I did.
"It's a little big," said Mrs. Stenson.
"It's perfect," said Mr. Ballard. And he looked at me with eyes like the brown pelicans. I drove home with him, wearing the flight jacket, carrying the orchid. I don't think I need to tell you what my mother did when she saw that orchid. But I do need to tell you what Lucas said when I told him I had a new flight jacket.
"Would it fit me?"
"Not in a million years," I said. He started to laugh.
"I guess you're right," he said, and laughed some more.
You know how good it was to hear Lucas laugh? It was even better than wearing this flight jacket, which, unless Joe Pepitone's jacket turns up, is the only thing I own that hasn't belonged to some other Swiatek before me. On Saturday morning, Mrs. Mason said that my flight jacket looked snazzy, and she wondered if someone who wore such a snazzy jacket would still like a chocolate donut, or if he was too grown up for that. I said I would love a chocolate donut, and she gave me a glass of cold milk so I could dunk it. Mr. Leffler said my new flight jacket reminded him of something, and he went up into his attic so he could find it while I brought the groceries in. I waited, and when he came back, he was wearing, I'm not lying, a flight jacket. Its brown leather was all creased and soft, and it had a yellow woolly collar and yellow woolly stuff at the ends of the sleeves.
"Mr. Leffler," I said, "that's terrific."
"Lieutenant Leffler," he said, and pulled the jacket trim around him. "Not bad. Not bad at all after 35 years. He was right. It wasn't bad at all. So I brought my feet together and my hand up, and I saluted him. Just kidding around. But you know what? He got this serious look on his face, like we weren't just kidding around in his kitchen. And he snapped his legs together and got straighter than I had ever seen him. And he whipped his arm up and saluted back. His hands weren't shaking. Not at all. And it sort of startled me. Not the salute, but because of his eyes. I think you can probably guess what they looked like. Ben, Polly, Joel, Davy, and Phronsie loved the flight jacket. They all wanted to try it on, and I let them, even though Joel almost disappeared in it,
and Davy and Phronsie could both have worn it together and still had plenty of room. Mrs. Windermere said my flight jacket made me look like Errol Flynn.